Okay, well, let's do it then. So we are in the, I call it the payoff section or the reward section of reading the will. You know, you've have my when my dad died, that's what, you know, almost like the lawyer calls you the next day and said, read the will, and said, already? Well, I guess it's important because the will is something that is important to the heirs. In our case, it's important to God because he's made this contract with humanity, not with Abraham, but with a humanity. Abraham is the go-to person. And so we're looking to see whether our assumption of taking the Bible literally has been the right assumption. And I think you'll agree, wouldn't be in this church probably if you didn't think that was the right way to read your Bible literally. And when we read the Bible literally, it comes to certain literal conclusions. And so far, we are on track. We don't think we should have changed our view. Now, we don't have a lot of prophecy that we can look at and say, well, we don't have a long track record. But we do have a couple of things. The diaspora would be one. The Jews have been scattered, and they are being regathered. And we also have that Israel has been declared themselves as an independent nation. So those are three prophecies that are that we can see have been fulfilled actually literally as the Bible said it would. So long ago, these promises were made. So, you know, we're in this payoff section, and this contract is over 4,000 years old. And I must mention that God administers this contract with a lot of mercy. There's a lot of failure on the part of humanity. There's a lot of failure on the part of Abraham. In fact, there's a lot of failure on our own part. And I'll talk about this verse later. But while we may be unfaithful, God is faithful, and we depend on that. So we'll really find some really, really weird things that are done by believers over the centuries. So this contract has been, since it's unconditional, unilateral, forcible only by God, it'll take a lot of mercy for this to stay intact. So the Reformed Covenantal Gentiles have envied the Jews, which is the opposite what God said it should be, that the Jews should envy the Gentiles, but it has been turned around that the Gentiles have actually envied the Jews and forced themselves to some kind of imagined spiritual kingdom, even though they were warned not to do so in Matthew 11. We have the bottom picture of a verse there, in the days of John the Baptist, till now the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and violent men take it by force. And that's kind of what's going on with the covenant reform people. They take the kingdom by force, mentally perhaps, but they think that God owes them the kingdom. But God is faithful, my verse here, and merciful, has continued to favor elect Israel, evidenced by their severe disciplines. So we have this verse in 2 Timothy 2:13 that if we are faithless, he remains faithful and he cannot deny himself. And that's a verse we have to go to when we find that we think they're believers, but why do they believe this, you know, or do this? You know, we have to say that there is this space in here that God will not deny himself, even though we may deny him. Although in the long run, we cannot deny him because we don't do that as believers. So this is an important verse when we think about all the missteps, the bad theology, the practices we see in Christian history over the centuries. Now, in the War of Gog, God has again begun to show him favoring them. After 1950 years, he will again openly, before the nations, defend Israel for the first time since the incarnation. Now, I say openly defend Israel. I'm going to make a distinction here. We have open favor versus divine providence, as we see in the days of the diaspora and in the Independence War in 1948 and the wars 67 and 73. Those are not the kind of open favor victories for Israel, because God really didn't show himself in this. But for people on the ground watching what's happening, like we would, and Israel perhaps, they would say, we know that God certainly caused this to happen, although it wasn't universally accepted in the world, is God's actions. So think of that. Finally, Gog, the Jews are getting their vindication from above in the eyes of the entire world. So the prophetic line from the rapture is as follows. We go from where we're going to move it to, move it back or a little up to the area between the rapture and the tribulation. So this adjustment from mid-tribulation is before the tribulation, but after the rapture is the most likely place for the Gog and Magog war. And since we're talking prophecy, no one can actually claim this as emphatic truth, but I think this is the best choice. That's right. That's what drove me to this position. There are other things that supported that, but that I could not see how God would be disciplining Israel and showing favor to the world at the same time. And we just basically can't say, well, God can do anything he wants to do. That don't work either. You know, they have to be within system realities. Yeah, that isn't where I started, but that's the one that finally made me think that it's probably the right position. So as we teach the rapture of the church, that can happen any time. So in our thinking, let's assume that it has happened. And I remember we did the rapture a while ago, and we are not part of the tribulation or will not be here for this war, I don't believe, because these verses, 1 Thessalonians 5:9, for God has not destined us for wrath. Now, that's not hell, as the verses talk about later here, because we're talking about the day of wrath. And you never talk about days in hell, because there aren't any. It's just eternity. So the day in hell is not the day of God's wrath. Hell is hell. You know. So when you talk about God's wrath, we have to talk about the wrath on this earth. So God has not destined us for wrath to wait for his son, that is Jesus, who rescues us from the wrath to come. See, that's not hell. It's something happens in this world. 1 Thessalonians 1:17. Oh, that's 10. Then go to Revelation 6:17. For the great day of their wrath has come. The day of wrath has come. Again, can't be hell because we don't talk about days in hell. So who is able to stand? So after the rapture, the world will be in shock. Do not understand how in shock they will be. The shock will be greater than any other worldwide event since the flood, since no one survived that shock except 8 people in the ark. So we can only speculate how long this adjustment will take in the minds of the people after the rapture. We can learn from the 9/11 attack that even the COVID-19 event, which we still don't know what the impact of that is going to be, but the 9/11 event has been 19 years and is still a major factor in our thinking about the present world. But the psychological and economic recovery must happen as life must go on. Everybody understands that. That's here, left over. Without the millions of Christians, and to some they might say good riddance. So a new normal will settle in probably quicker than you think, although with a lot of difficulties. I do believe that once the rapture has occurred, the events of the day of the Lord will transpire in rapid succession. I don't mean decades. I don't mean centuries. I mean in a few years. It could be 10 years. I don't know. But in a few years. We have suggested at least 3.5 years are necessary to keep the weapon-burning stage out of the second half of the tribulation and out of the kingdom, which is where I started my problem with this whole thing. So after the rapture, economic depression. With the best of workers, hopefully gone, Christians, they're out of the workforce. There will be thousands, maybe millions of key jobs that have to be filled with leftover population. For some of these positions, it takes years to prepare as a physician or airline pilots or some technicians of all kinds. Some companies will just cease to function because absent ownership. So the recovery will be slow and production will be stymied. Abandoned and disputed property, think about the house you live in or the building you own, the warehouse, whatever. Abandoned disputed property will likely be dormant and be tied up in lawsuits between claimants, family, too bad to say, family heirs, and the government. In the meantime, real estate properties will deteriorate. Fire and water main breaks will flood and destroy property since the former owners raptured cannot maintain them. You go to any place that's been deserted for very long, they will have fires. I mean, they just happen. When people don't live there, they don't take care of the properties, and things happen like a water main breaks and leads to another thing that leads to a fire. So these things will no doubt happen. And we talk, at least in the Western world, in Northern America, in large numbers. In the West, at least, the economy may not be able to utilize the value of the abandoned property. So look at all the value that's left. Now we can just jump in. Probably can't use it very well. The bank accounts will be confiscated to satisfy loans that aren't being made. Relatives may fight over assets. New draconian emergency measures are generated by the government, and we know how that works, that will make life difficult. Freedoms will be lost in the name of health, order, and public safety. And I think we've had a trial run with it in these last couple of 4 months. So in our country, just think of it. Now, this is a conjecture, but think about it. If the president, who supposedly, by his confession, is a believer, let's just say that he is, and the vice president, by open confession, is, and they're raptured, who is the leader of the government then? That's right. Now, just think about that. Not funny here. Just think about that. If that would happen, and the Speaker of the House would be the president, can you imagine how quickly things would degenerate? I mean, if you listen to what she says, if she's going to follow through on what she means. So think about that. We have these two are removed, and we have the opportunity of a lifetime for the left. So a police state, a new police state would immediately arise that would exist with probably martial law imposed. You can't have chaos. Everybody knows that except, you know, it's argument who has the guns. That's the real argument here. It is interesting that the Bible is silent about these kind of events. So you think, well, one, the Bible tells us what's going to happen after the rapture on earth, you know? Well, God's program is not where he stops to view the wreckage. That's not what he does. What he does is prepare you and focus on the future and prepare for it. It doesn't explain what happens. So we have to imagine in our mind what it would be like, and part of that helps us to prepare for the future. And, of course, I always say my little thing that I send to you every week is prepare to meet your God. That is the message of all of this, if you haven't seen it already. So with vacant homes flooding the market, it may cause both a loss of their value. How do you get a clear title of people that are not that are not present, and you cannot be declared dead for 7 years without a body? So this interesting 7 years. Fed by the loss of the value of currency, high inflation, low production, making cash useless, we have an economy that's in shambles. These conditions could well reach into the first 3.5 years of the tribulation when the Antichrist imposes draconian measures on a made willing population. I'll do anything, just give me some peace and prosperity. Anything will do it. Anything to salvage out of life. Health issues will explode. Many people die from lack of care. Free market is doomed because a government bureaucratic management, because they feel they have to grab a hold of the economy and do something, and everything the government does something with it, it ruins it, except for a few exceptions. It is here after the rapture of the nations in some kind of recovery state that the war of Gog takes place. In this chaos, this war takes place. For the Muslim nations, think about that. The rapture may not provide the same shock to Islam's dominance where a general ignorance of Christian truth exists. In fact, the rapture may embolden them. Did not Allah remove their Satan enemy? And they might see this as a real opportunity that they've never had before. The Christians are gone. Half their enemies are gone. And we're a bigger enemy to them than actually Israel is. So now they're motivated for the attack. With the support of Israel, as found in the fundamentalists in the West, gone, the Middle East location, the center of the earth, looks to Gog as ripe for harvest. Hook in the jaw. Gog may look to the West and see disarray and opportunity. Russia is not evangelical. Fewer Christians may see this as a time to act. Well, after the rapture, remember, the Jews have enjoyed a brief passage of relative peace with the fundamentalist evangelical West, at least having morally supported Israel, but they have disappeared with the rapture. So Gog is aware of their vulnerability. With Muslim support, Gog takes the opportunity to annihilate Israel in their land. Well, we've talked about this. Some of these things we already talked about. We'll do it again. The attack must have some kind of advance notice, since the young lions, probably the West, observe the rattling of war machinery. They demur, yes, but do not come to Israel's defense. They don't like it, but they're not going to come to Israel's defense. Remember, the support for Israel came from the fundamentalist evangelicals, not the liberal leftists of the New World, the neo-Marxists. The New World, the neo-Marxists. With the fundamentalists gone in the government as we have them today, the United States, including NATO, will only take a look-see attitude and watch from a distance. or it happened so fast they could not respond. And remember, Israel is not part of NATO. So it is possible that the United States is so crippled by the rapture and the leftist adjustments that there is no strength or desire to defend Israel anyway. If the West can observe the war preparation of Gog, it is certain that Israel will be aware of these preparations too. But uncharacteristic of Israel, who would use preemptive action, does not do so here. It may be that the war is coming from too many places to strike, and think about this, and choose to wait for the attack in their own homeland. We know that the Jews will not move out of the land again. They've said that repeatedly to us when we've been there. Where would they go, I ask? Where would Israel go if they were to be kicked out of the land? What land would say, come over here? There's just no place to go. Sometimes they, well, they'll be kicked out of the land. Well, they got to have someplace to go. Well, Islam has never said we'd kick you out of the land. They said we'd kick you into the Mediterranean Sea. They would annihilate them. So where would the Jews go? They will not move out of the land again. Where would they go? They will shelter at home, and that's their plan. If war comes again, we're sheltering at home. In fact, every apartment has a bomb shelter in it, made of concrete. Every apartment that's built has that. It's a law. So they will shelter at home in their own country. They are prepared, so to speak. And if this is to be total war, you know what total war is? Total war is when everything you have is thrown into the battle. The women, that's why women in Israel pick up guns and are part of the army, because they know if they ever are attacked, it will be total war. And everything that Israel has to throw at the war is going to be used in their defense. And that includes, there are no gender issues here. It's, we're defending our nation. Everybody's doing that. That's what total war is. No cost is too great. Nobody gets exempt. No one has a furlough or no one's exemption to farm. Everybody's in the war. That's what's called total war. So if this to be total war, and I think it is, they are better off in their own territory. They got their own stuff right there. They got the bomb shelters there. They got the equipment there. They've got their missiles there, whatever. You know, that's how they think. If this to be total war, they are better off in their own country. The great road systems are built that we get to drive on, which are better than any system I've ever been on, are built for transporting their military gear to the hot spots. That's why we have these wonderful roads they've built. So the great road system and the home sheltering built in Israel is for defensive purpose, and they openly state that. So they're not going anywhere. Now, the execution of the war of Gog is reminiscent of the day of Hezekiah, an overnight victory. And I'm not sure I'm going to make this an overnight victory. I don't know for sure how long this is going to last. There are things about it make me think it's going to go on. But in Hezekiah's, it was an overnight victory. Although the threat was for a while, enough time for Hezekiah, who is dressed in sackcloth, so where he's going to be attacked, digs a water tunnel, Hezekiah's tunnel. He had enough time to dig that. That would be quite a quarter mile long through rock. It takes a while to do that. So he's aware of being attacked, but not knowing when, although the prophet says, Isaiah says, don't be worried, the city will be delivered. And it was. Sennacherib did fall. Overnight, an angel killed 185,000 Syrian troops. The outcome of Gog is the same, an utter defeat of the enemy. Now, we have questions about the details. How come they come as a cloud, it says? Could this be an air attack? Of course, that's coming in the air. That is what we expect today, but there could be some landing craft because the shores of the Mediterranean are shared by Turkey and Israel. So they could land. That's the only one that I know of these nations, have actual access to a shoreline unless you come through the Gibraltar, which is probably unlikely. So if you go land by water, you have access from Turkey, and they are one of the belligerent states in this war. If this is a war like World War II, we would think that the plan would be to bomb, destroy the infrastructure, the electrical grid, the communications command center, the road system, the bridges, the water and oil supplies, the Knesset in Jerusalem. And then they send the foot soldiers with boots on the ground to effect total victory over Israel. That would be the normal plan. So another solution maybe is used here. Depends on the miraculous for both sides. If God wants Israel to be surprised, attacked, he could put the whole nation to sleep so that the enemy can, without restraint, fly in their troops or land them in the shores of the Mediterranean with no infrastructure bombing. Of course, this will take supernatural power to accomplish. It's not likely unless we claim it's happening in the day of the Lord when the miraculous becomes common. So that, we want to rule that out. And that may be the answer to the logistics. Again, we're appealing to the miraculous. The enemy immediately appears at the gate with Jewish homes ready to fight. Again, it seems impossible for God to be in the land facing the Jews, ready to destruct them, and the Jews make no attempt to stop them. That is so uncharacteristic of the Jews. Again, the logistics to pull this off seems impossible, yet God wants Gog to be in that very place. Just as it appears that the victory is Gog's, the earthquake shakes the land and all chaos breaks loose. As the earth shakes, discombobulates, destroys, interrupts troop movement in the confusion, the soldiers apparently turn to kill his companion. Dire illness strikes. Now that makes me think it takes a little bit of time, because if illness to set in, you die from it. Usually it takes a few days, but I don't know. It could be hours, but in the illness strikes. And troops and the weather turn sour as the sky opens up, torrential rain, hail, falling sulfur. I'm not sure about the burning here, but that could easily be here. That sticks to surfaces, burns everything it touches. And it's kind of a terrible destructive thing. The troops cannot carry out their task. Disruption comes from below, from above, and from within as diseases. Now, I was going to study on this a little more. Some have suggested that even the homelands of these belligerent nations are destroyed. I've not seen that. There's verse to the side because I don't see it in us. So that may be some that you might have thought about, and I just need to look into that a little bit more. But I probably won't because we're moving on. But you never know. I might think about it. Well, with the war over in the night, not sure how long, we need to be reminded that the number of troops are huge that have come. This is not a small squad of army, you know, but an overwhelming horde. And how did they get there? Again, we ask, how did they sneak in that quickly? It has been noted that only the Muslim armies can match the description of hordes. What they do not have in expertise or technology, they have in the number of troops they can field. We know that the number is great, since it takes 7 months and more to find the bodies and bury them. Now, we're going to assume there are no Israeli casualties because they're not stated, given. None are mentioned, and the victory statement would be not clear if Israel had even a small number of fatalities. So the victory is absolute. What is left is to bury the dead. 7 months and more, it says after 7 months, then they go out and look for more bones. So it's 7 months and more that they look for these bones. Israel must be in some kind of state of pride shock. Look what God did for us. Wow, aren't we special? Knowing they survived the Gog by miracles, but they are not ready to receive their Messiah. Life goes on as it does for the Gentiles after the rapture. They are grateful for the booty left by the army, used it to fuel their industry for 7 years. We believe that after the rapture, nations are freely able to move towards globalization, the detractors having disappeared largely. The Western weakness led to the Gog War. With West's loss of power, many Mideast nations move to act in this vacuum. But Islam is handed a defeat from which it will never recover, with Russia and the Muslim nations no longer world players. So Israel's stronger and more stable situation, this attracts the attention of the revived Roman Empire leader. Now we're heading towards the tribulation. It is true that the major enemy of Israel has been defeated, yet there is widespread Semitism, as there always is. Israel being alone, fundamentalists haven't gone with the rapture, the Muslim threat zero. A new alliance with a strong world power would allow Israel to go back to being Israel and not worry about international threats. And I thought about this after I had this done. You know, if the Antichrist looks, world ruler here, is smart at all, he looks at Israel and said, look at that, God protected Israel. I'm going to be their friend. And then he has second thoughts about it. But let's just say that's how he gets into this alliance with Israel. Says, was it, no, obviously they don't want to be against the God of Israel. Well, so I'm going to make an alliance with them because then maybe I have favor with God too. Now that won't last. He said, well, I don't like this after all. And he turns on Israel. But how he gets into this could well be Because he certainly knows about the war and how that all the nations will know that God interfered or intervened for them. So just an interesting thought, again, that propels the Antichrist into this alliance with Israel. And they're ready to accept it. The old Roman Empire reached the European West to the Middle East. Three Roman empires came from the so-called Middle East. So we don't know for sure where the emperor come from. Some think it'll be a Roman person, but Rome is anybody within that area. Some of you suggested Assyria. I don't understand all this. I don't have to have a position. So we'll leave that go. But it does come from the Roman Empire. Remember, the Roman Empire is more than the 10 Western nations in the European common market. It's a lot bigger than that. Earlier, as we set the economic political picture after the rapture as chaotic, add to the defeat of the Muslim nations and Russia in Gog, we think that these global events are still factors when the ruler out of the old Roman Empire begins to make his ambitious move, just kind of what I just mentioned. It is true that Europe, including the Middle East, excepting Israel, has suffered under poor leadership. World War II stopped the European infighting, but there's never risen a leader that all could follow. Remember, this has been said many times. But that's about to change. So we have in Daniel 7:7, we have this beast that comes up with 10 horns. In verse 8, 7:8, and while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three other first were pulled out by its roots before it, and behold, this horn possessed eyes and so forth. So we see the Antichrist coming up here. And we find that he makes this 70 weeks to determine when Israel is to get their tribulation, to bring in righteousness, talk about the incarnation, so forth. Then there are two verses, and he will, this Antichrist will make a firm covenant. We're going faster, I'm assuming you understand this. We make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, 7 years, but in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abomination will come one who makes desolate even until a complete destruction. When it is decreed, it is poured out on the one who makes desolate. All right, so that's the Antichrist. What is he going to do? So this is where that happens. Now, in the middle of the tribulation where he turns on Israel, but we're not going to look there yet. We're going to keep focusing on the beginning of it. Who the revived Roman Empire will be cannot be known in the church age, so don't worry trying to figure it out. However, the need for such a unifying ruler is evident even today. The picture of clay and iron feet on the image is a good description of the nations, European nations, that Europe would make an alliance with the devil, sure, to effect unification, of course, but for us a little bit breathtaking. But that is the case as Europe and the Middle East struggle for identity and unity. Well, the theme of Ezekiel, as you remember years ago, the theme of Ezekiel is the restoration of Israel. The early chapters recount Israel's unfaithfulness, the nation's treatment of Israel, and all that. And then we come to chapters 35 and 39, 36, 39 in there somewhere, and the fortunes of Israel begin returning in the Gog and Magog War, which is a full vindication of God's choice of Israel as his chosen one. Since Ezekiel's message is restoration, it does not include the tribulation period. You understand that? Since Ezekiel's message is restoration, it does not focus on their discipline. That's why it's not in Ezekiel. That's my argument. Since Ezekiel's message is restoration, it does not include the restoration period. It cannot be in the tribulation, so the argument, God cannot be in the tribulation as we have argued. Now we're going to chapter 40. The next verses are kingdom prophecies. Now, Jordan, you think about that. We go from Ezekiel 39, the Gog War, the next breath, now we have chapters. For us, the next chapter, verse 40, everybody understands we now are talking about kingdom truth, which is something called the millennial truth. I like to make it better than kingdom because the millennium is just the first part of the kingdom. So it's kingdom truth. The next verses are kingdom practice in keeping with the theme of Ezekiel. It is universally recognized that Ezekiel 40 through 48, that's nine chapters describe the kingdom temple in great detail. It's huge. It is huge. And some people get mixed up, just off the subject. Some people get mixed up and think that the Mosaic law will be reinstituted in the kingdom. That's wrong. It's the Melchizedekian order. And will there be laws with that? Yes, there will be, but not the Mosaic law. So some people want to resurrect the Mosaic law for the kingdom. That's not true. Okay? And they want to paint you bad things with that. So don't get confused. It's because the Melchizedekian order, which is what Hebrew makes the point. All right. All right. So a universally recognized Ezekiel 40:48 describes kingdom temple in detail. Ezekiel timeline from 38:39 then is from the victory over Gog to the kingdom, verse chapter 40. And the supreme focus on these chapters is the temple. Now, what is the temple for in the kingdom? This is so easy. What are you going to put in the kingdom? What's going to be in the temple in the kingdom? One thing. One thing it's going to have. Right. Thank you. I knew it. So I know you didn't want to say it because it looks so simple. The throne of God's going to be there. I mean, he's coming to earth to reign, right? Jesus is going to come to earth to reign. David's going to sit on his throne. I think Jesus will reign over the world and David will reign over Israel, but they're both reigning in the temple. You know, because the temple and the government now is mixed together. In the Mosaic order, you couldn't mix them. In the Melchizedekian order, you can mix them. They can't be the same person. The priest and king can be the same person in the Melchizedekian order. So we have this tremendous 9 chapters explaining basically where God's going to reside in the temple on earth during the kingdom, which is what's been promised. Okay, now that shouldn't have shocked you a lot. So the first verse, sort of go by it because it doesn't really relate to what we're doing here. But we'll read it. In the 25th year of our exile, we're back in Babylon. Beginning of the year, and I have the date here, 572 apparently, depending on exactly when Ezekiel was exiled. After the city was taken, there we have it, 586. Then we take another, how many years did he say? 25th year of our exile. Hope I did my math right. And on the same day, the hand of the Lord came upon me, and he brought me there. In the visions of God, he brought me into the land of Israel, and he set me on a very high mountain. I've got the picture here, but I don't know how I draw a high mountain over here. You'd have to have some kind of, you know, this doesn't work because these are just figures. Because you put them on a high mountain over here, and it'd be hard for him to, you know, the curvature. I don't want to get into that stuff. So we obviously have a figurative mountain here that's up and lifted up. Maybe we should put the mountain out here in space. And he's sitting over here, and he's looking and seeing something. That's probably how a prophet would see things. He's not really connected with what he's seeing. He's from somewhere else looking into it. So in the vision of God, he brought me to the land of Israel, brought his attention to the land of Israel, put me on a high mountain. On it to the south, I don't know what the direction was, so he would have been to the north. I don't know what direction I made here. There was a structure like a what? City. City. Really, a city. Well, we find out that city is Jerusalem. Is that a surprise? Would it be a surprise to you that it's the New Jerusalem? Okay, now where does the New Jerusalem come from? That's right. It's been prepared by Jesus after he said, John 14, I'm going to go away. Prepare a place for you, and where I am, you may come, and there will be with me forever to be your home, your address. So now look in Revelation 21:10, what it says. And he carried me away, this is John, in the spirit to a great high mountain. And he showed me the holy city, not the temple. Let's say the holy city has the temple. So the temple's in the holy city. So holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. Then we jump ahead to another chapter, and there will be no longer any curse, and the throne of God and the Lamb of God will be in it, and his bondservants will serve him. So on the bottom here, we have this picture of the temple I didn't do this. I didn't think about the orientations. I'm not going to be stand for its correctness. But it does show the size of the temple, which is in the city of the New Jerusalem, which is on earth. Now, we get into a problem with logistics. Well, how is that going to happen? I can't imagine the two things in one place. I can't either. I can't explain Jesus' body going in and out of the rooms that open the doors. So we have a new system here in the millennium. We have things that didn't exist before. We have some things that continue to exist, but there are things that are not new, that are new to us. So we have this temple is, you know, here is, I thought it was 50 miles. This is 50 miles this way and 21 miles this way. If I drew this temple, it might draw different. I see Manfred Kober has his own little sketches. He's on internet sometimes. He's from Iowa to East Coast on the what we do in the early American tour. And he's got a little kind of an artist guy presented it a little bit differently. But the point is that there's going to be this massive structure where Israel is. And the way he draws it, sometimes maybe they turn it the other way. So you'd have 50 miles from the Mediterranean to the Dead Sea, which is about what it would be. And then it's raised up to lofty heights. And I said, well, again, that doesn't seem terribly impossible, because if I just think about logistics, right now Israel is at 2,400 high feet in elevation. Well, it says it's going to be mile high, so I'm already halfway there. So it isn't like it's this, you know, 10,000 feet. It's not that. It's 5,000, like a mile. And the present landscape already shows it at half a mile. Okay, so that's how high this is going to be. And it's going to be on a plateau. And all this happens because the earth, remember, has been shook, been shaken, it's been cracked like an egg, and it's been reorganized. All this has happened. Now the temple comes. So all that is somewhat reasonable in terms of logistics, but I can't give the details of it. So anyway, this is what we have here. A very striking parallel between Ezekiel 40, verse 2, and Revelation 21, and chapter 21, and verse chapter 22. So this is a snapshot. This is a snapshot of where we're going in the kingdom. We are not there yet. We have a few years to cover. That is the tribulation. Then the setting up of the eternal kingdom after the second advent. In Ezekiel 40, verse 2, and later, in Revelation 21, we have a parallel time and information as the throne of God comes to earth in the new city of Jerusalem that is descended from heaven. And I say here, please do not focus on logistics. When you say, I can't see how that can happen, never judge tomorrow's prophetic otherworldly ideas by the way things are today. That's a mistake. So do not focus on logistics, but remain with the facts and allow the logistics to be understood in time to come. And that is as far as I can go with the time that I have, but I do have 2 minutes or 3 minutes left, so go at it. Revelation 21:10 and 22:3. I'm glad somebody pays attention. Probably, if they're going to have any effect, just think of it this way. If there's going to be, and we don't even know that they're evangelists. I mean, it doesn't say that. We just assume, well, what else would they be, you know, kind of by default. So if that's what they're going to be, an assumption, and I think that's right, what good would it do to put it at the end of the tribulation? So where would you think they'd have the most effect? I mean, you just think logically, where most effect would be in the beginning of the tribulation. And for sure, in the first half. Some might say in the middle, I don't know. I think most people think it's in the, just because of the effect of it, the longer you wait with them in the tribulation, the less effect they have, the less time they have to actually do the evangelizing. And when they evangelize, that don't necessarily mean that they have converts. They'll have some, but remember, Israel doesn't listen to these guys. Israel doesn't listen to the one that raised back from the dead, the two witnesses. They don't listen to those guys. This is Israel, the unbelieving secular Israelite. Does not believe in him. They will not believe on him until the end. Now, there are always the remnants of their population that do believe. So it's probably like they'd be a high percentage like we would be. But on the other hand, all those evangelists have gone out and shared the message. so that when Christ does come, they say, now I understand. So they have an effect, even though they may not actually evangelize to the point that they're saved. Because if you have 144,000, they each go out and save 100 or 1,000 a year. We'd think they'd have, you know, everybody saved by that time. So I don't think that's happening, because Israel does not turn to Israel does not turn to God until the second event when they see him coming. But the evangelists still do their work like we do. We put out the message, and we sometimes say, well, you know, our family members, let's say they're not believers, and say, well, after we're gone, maybe they'll remember what we told them. That's why we tell them now, because we can't tell them when we're gone. Maybe they'll remember it then. Yeah. But the Jews that do get saved, they get martyred too. You know, so just like there's no protection here. Yeah, the third, yeah. Third that is left. Yeah. You know, it shows, I think, that the kingdom starts with a small seed population of Gentiles and Jews. I mean, there's just going to be so many killed and die from everything, including war, disease, that there will just be few left. And many of them will be taken out because of their unbelief. They're judged and removed. So you end up with a very, very small group. Now, again, I remember this kind of talk about something Gil talked about Sunday night, that the number of Jews that have come to what they call Messianic Jews today, around 400,000. And I checked that number, and Wikipedia even give 350 as of 2012. And my number comes from a guy named Oliver Melnick from Moody. And he said there's 400,000 Jews. So my opinion has always been kind of like, wow, the Jews are actually more responsive to the gospel than the Gentiles are. Because you take 400,000 out of 14 million, do the percentage, and you got, 7 billion people on the earth, and you figure maybe there's 2% of them believers. I don't think there's 2% born-again believers. So the Jews still have a bigger percentage of the population being believers than the Gentiles do. And then I think the Gentiles claim they're so obedient to the word. Excuse me, again, there we go, getting ourselves into trouble. Gentiles get themselves in trouble. Okay, this thing on Isaiah 40, verse 2, was a new thing. I never saw that till this lesson. I thought, you know, it's interesting how that goes. When you see things, I never would have thought about it before. He just sees a city. Well, it looks like a city. But you tie it into what Revelation says about the city. It said, well, why? That is always what you find. The Revelation always picks up something out of the Old Testament and brings it forward. And the throne room of God is going to be in the city. I mean, unless you have a weird view of God's throne, but it's Jesus will rule on earth. And so where is that going to be? It's not going to be in Bangladesh or Munster, Germany. It's going to be in Jerusalem, which is the center of the earth. Okay, get your masks. Get ready to put them on. I think that we are now, this is extra. I think that the world, this is more than just the United States, right? This whole virus. The world is having a trial run at how to control the masses. And they know how to do it. So, I mean, when your life, your health is threatened, you'll give up anything, you know, for one more breath of air. You know, I can put on my mask and says I can't breathe. So, another precious thought just escaped me. Have expired. Yeah. You can't say the Lord will come soon. No, the days have expired already. This is another thought. You're going to heaven, the rapture, being with the Lord and being there is almost a scary thing. because we've never been there before. And it's so theoretical. So now it's still theoretical. Has anybody done it in this room? Have you read of anybody that ever has done it and come back talking about it? No. So it's all, for us, theoretical, or we call theological. Now, we have one hope going for us because we believe that God has told us that. But it still is theoretical that you're going to like that place, whatever. And when you get there, say, I don't ever want to go back. I can't imagine thinking that. I love this place. I think the world is wonderful. God made it for us. It's for us to enjoy. It's sin that messed it up. So I have a little bit of apprehension of going somewhere else. So for us, we say, we're ready to go to heaven. Yes, we are, and we are. So when we die, the coronavirus or whatever gets us, old age, we're going there, but still theoretical for us. I think the Bible calls it living by faith. I think that's what it's called, and we're supposed to do that. And I think so many times God could have intervened and said, just fix this thing. I'm reading the prayers and how they get their form of government and church polity straightened out in the 16th, 17th centuries. I said, you know, if God would just, you know, send them a note and say, don't do this anymore, then everything would be fixed. But God sits there and says, no, I told them and let them work it out. And it's going to be extremely difficult for them to work it out if they don't believe God from the beginning. If they don't believe the Anabaptist, that you don't baptize babies, if you don't believe them from the beginning, you would have spent 200-300 years worth of trouble, and a lot of the trouble we have today would not be existing in Christianity. If they just would have looked over the fence, looked at the Anabaptists, doing, wow, those Anabaptists, they don't baptize babies. They're wrong. Now, what are we going to do is right. You know, to me, it's like the carpenter that's building a house. He's building a roof, and he's putting rafters up, and the guy calls out, I need a rafter. It's 14 feet long. And he shoves up the rafter, and it's not 14 feet long. It's 13 feet long. He says, it's too short. And the guy said, no problem. I'll cut off some more. That's kind of what the covenant people have done. They keep cutting off the rafter, and they're never building it to completion. So anyway, that's going to be my Wednesday study in the fall, if we're here, because we have run out of time on the clock and run out of time for the rapture. Let's pray.